This is Backstory. I'm Ed Ayers.
America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States.
This is Malcolm X, speaking in 1964. He's making an argument that may sound familiar today, but keep listening and you'll hear something a little odd.
What is that number? What article is that? The Second Amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, right there. Malcolm X didn't know where in the Constitution the right to bear arms is protected? He had to ask his friend? It turns out that the Second Amendment didn't really feature in the gun rights debate for most of the 20th century. As late as 1975, even the NRA said the Second Amendment was of, quote, limited practical utility, end quote, in arguing for gun ownership. A history of guns in America, today on Backstory. But first, some history in the making.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities and by the University of Virginia.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century Guy, and I'm here with Ed Ayers.
19th Century Guy.
And Peter Onuf, the one and only...
18th Century Guy.
Today's show is about the history of guns in America, and frankly, when it comes to guns, I don't know how you start anywhere else in American history besides the Wild West.
Out in the untamed wilderness of the Wild West, everyone had guns.
This is Adam Winkler, a law professor at UCLA and author of Gunfight, the battle over the right to bear arms in America.
If you were going from place to place where there was no law out in the frontier, you needed guns to protect yourself.
There were hostile Indians, outlaws.
There were wild animals. You were out there alone. There was no law, and so much so that stagecoach drivers that went from town to town took to great expense to hire someone to ride sitting next to them with a shotgun in their hand right there in the front of the stagecoach.
And for all you listeners currently sitting in the passenger seat of the car, this is, in fact, where we get the phrase, riding shotgun.
So everyone out in the Wild West had guns, and you needed them out in the Wild West. But when you came into a town like a Tombstone, Arizona, or a Dodge City, Kansas, where the business people and the civilized people lived, your guns weren't welcome there. These towns had the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation. When you walked into a Wild West town, you had to check your guns the way you might check your overcoat in a restaurant in the winter, and you'd get a little token that you can use to get back your guns when you're leaving the town.
So this probably doesn't square with your image of the Wild West, gun-toting drunkards stumbling through the streets of Deadwood, ready to blow away the next guy who crosses their path. I mean, what about gunfights?
What about the O.K. Corral?
Well, the shootout at the O.K. Corral is the most famous or infamous gunfight in American history. On one side of the street were lined up Ike Clanton and a group of outlaw cowboys, and on the other side of the street we had the famous Wyatt Earp and the Earp brothers, the lawmen of the town.
Wait a minute, Wyatt. Kate told me about the killing of your brother.
This is a clip from the 1957 film Gunfight at the O.K. Corral.
It was a Clanton's, all right. And you were in on it.
I had nothing to do with it.
Get back where you belong.
Believe me, Wyatt, if...
Get back with your friends.
Hit the dirt!
And shots rang out, and three people died, and several others were injured. The reason why the dispute between the Clantons and the Earps turned deadly was because the Clanton gang refused to turn over their weapons, as required by Tombstone law. So some people think that the shootout at the O.K. Corral was typical of the Wild West. That's how we view these Wild West towns, cowboys running roughshod, guns ablaze night and day. But in truth, gun violence was very rare in the quote-unquote gun havens of the Wild West, places like Tombstone, Arizona, or Dodge City, Kansas, or Deadwood, South Dakota. Over the period of the Wild West, roughly 1870 to the 1890s, towns like Tombstone or Dodge City, they averaged less than two murders a year. And in most years during those periods, they had zero murders. So the reason why we're still talking about the shootout at the OK Corral 130 years later is because it was an extraordinary event. It was an unusual event that made headlines coast to coast that three people were shot in a shootout. Whereas today, in Los Angeles, if three people are shot, it might not even make the front page of the local newspaper. So the shootout at the OK Corral, while often taken to be emblematic of America's gun culture, I think also is a story of America's gun control culture, about the ways in which gun control has shaped America as much as the six shooter or the Second Amendment.
Today on the show, we're exploring the history of guns in the United States. Who has them? Who wants them? The United States has the highest rate of civilian gun ownership in the world, nearly one privately owned firearm for every man, woman, or child.
And who could forget the number of high-profile shootings this year? From Trayvon Martin in Florida, to a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, to a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, gun violence made headlines and sparked questions about who should have access to guns in the first place.
So in this hour of Backstory, that's the question we'll be pushing back through the centuries. How have Americans figured out who should be able to own guns?
What did that debate look like in the years after the Civil War, when new kinds of guns were flooding the North and the South? What did it look like 100 years later, when black activists were using terms like, by any means necessary? And yes, what did it look like in the founding generation to those guys who actually came up with that whole business about the right to bear arms?
It's pretty hard to talk about gun ownership today without somebody bringing up the Second Amendment. That's the one that says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. These days, people tend to focus on the last part of the sentence, the right to bear arms. But what about the beginning? What was that whole business about the militia?
You may remember from your history books that it was the members of the Massachusetts militia, the Minutemen, who fought the first battle of the American Revolution. And that was prompted by British soldiers trying to take some of their weapons. Well, militias were amateur armies, organized first by colonial governments and then later by the states of the new nation. The Constitution would later give Congress the power to arm the militia, and the basic idea was that male citizens over a certain age were required to report for duty periodically, and to do so with guns in hand.
So how easy would it have been for colonists to get their hands on a gun? Peter put that question to Kevin Sweeney, a historian at Amherst College, who has researched gun ownership going all the way back to the 1600s.
There are a couple of actual musters, they're called, from Virginia in 1619 and again in 1624-25. In both of those cases, there are more firearms in the colony than there are males over 16.
Wow.
It doesn't mean each one of these males over 16 own one, but there are enough firearms around that in case of an emergency, each one could possess one.
Right. So the 17th century seems like something like a golden age of gun ownership and gun use.
Well, in terms of widespread,
right,
they seem to have been widely armed, but not necessarily
well,
well armed. I mean,
exactly.
These weapons in the 1600s were not that reliable. They were, you know, inclined to misfire or foul. And early on, it's clear that not many of these colonists were necessarily Daniel Boone's in the making. They probably spent a lot of their time in non-military ways, shooting at birds on the ground. Basically, you get as close as you could on the ground and shoot kind of scattershot at them. probably not a lot of hunting of particularly animals like deer. They frequently employed Native Americans to do that.
So Kevin, let's move toward back toward Concord. Sure. And Lexington and the Minutemen. And where are we on the eve of the American Revolution in terms of the militias? How well armed are they?
It's best to maybe just take a slight step back to the 1750s during what we know as the French and Indian War, because mm-hmm. that's really a turning point in terms of both military organization and the understanding of what were appropriate types of firearms to use in military activities and even to have in the possession of militiamen at the time. For years, you'd been able to show up with anything at most militia musters. Didn't even have to work, long as it looked like it could. But when you're sending troops into the field, you want them with appropriate arms. And by this period, and this is true going into the Revolution as well, 20 years later in the 1770s, they want increasingly a military-grade musket. This would be a much heavier weapon. It was sturdier, rugged.
And Kevin, were they more expensive?
Yes, these are a bit more expensive, but they're also not necessarily otherwise a weapon you'd want to own. It's not a hunting weapon. But increasingly, this is what the governments felt you had to have in the field. So going into the American Revolution, these colonial governments, the rebelling governments, scrambled to come up with weapons that they felt met those criteria.
So, Kevin, the important point you're making, it seems to me, is that all guns are not created equal. And the kind of guns that were important in the French and Indian War and later the American Revolution were, as you say, for offensive use. And it was very unlikely that the average family would have such a weapon.
Yes. And, you know, Jefferson, who spent probably the worst year of his life as governor of Virginia in 1780, trying to defend the state, and into 81, you know, comments on the fact that, yeah, people have firearms and shotguns for, you right. know, controlling vermin, I think he said, or, mm-hmm. you know, animals and things like that. But they don't have rugged military quality weapons you can put a bayonet on. And this is what you want to have, particularly if you're taken half seriously while, you know, facing professional British forces.
Right.
So one of the interesting things at the Constitutional Convention, when they're explaining that clause about the power of Congress to, you know, organize, discipline, and arm the militia, Madison says, "What do you mean by arm?" And initially, Rufus King of Massachusetts says, "Well, to specify, you know, the caliber and characteristics of the weapons." And Madison comes back, and he clearly wants someone to arm them. Uh-huh. And this comes up at the Virginia Ratifying Convention for the Constitution. They are concerned about the militia being, you know, disarmed, but their concern is someone else won't arm them. It's not that, you know, somebody's going to come around and knock on doors and take away their guns. It's the state government's not going to give these guys guns or sell them guns at affordable levels.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. It's been great talking with you about the history, the complicated history of guns in early America. Thanks so much.
I very much enjoyed it. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's Kevin Sweeney. He's a professor of history at Amherst College.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, what the right to bear arms meant for blacks in the 1860s and the 1960s.
We'll be back in a minute with more backstory.
We're back with backstory. I'm Brian Ballow, your 20th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century guy.
And I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy.
Today on the show, the history of gun ownership in America. Before the break, we were hearing about the citizen soldiers of the founding era and how poorly armed they would have been if the government hadn't provided them with weapons. So maybe we could take a few minutes, guys, and talk about what happened next. So, Peter, what did we learn about guns from the actual revolution itself?
Well, you've got to get ready for the next war, Brian. You know about this. And that means you've got to have guns in place. Collectively, you have to have armories. You know, the militia, that's the citizenry. They are going to rise up on the occasion. But when they rise up, you got to put arms in their hands, so to speak, so that they can fight the war. So the idea that somehow you just had to tap into an existing gun culture where there was universal gun ownership and just mobilize that is nonsense. There wouldn't be armories, and I think that's the point where we want to underscore state armories. There wouldn't be those armories if there were universal gun ownership.
So people don't get to keep their guns when the government gives it to them. They got to hand them back.
No, yeah, and if you have a more local armories, and you go to muster day for the militia, mm-hmm. you get the guns for that day,
you
march with them, but then you give them back because they're complicated machines.
Yeah, and they,
you know,
and
they need to be protected.
They deteriorate. I mean, they have to be maintained in working order.
Right.
Well-armed. Underscore the well part of it.
It's interesting, back in the time of the Revolution, the early national period, they're thinking about what makes a legitimate state in the eyes mm-hmm. of the world. Well, you have to be able to protect yourself.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
right.
So the national government actually begins what feels kind of like a 20th century model of active subsidy and innovation.
I love
at the Harper's Ferry Armory. They say, we need guns that have interchangeable parts so that we can actually, well, interchange them so that can keep these guns operable and across a wide space. So if these guns that are being produced by the government have to be used in one place or another, we can ship them parts that can fix. So
right.
what we think of as the American system, Brian, that we think about with the Model T, is actually developed for armories to develop guns.
Okay, so in effect, the state primes the pump.
Yes, but it really wasn't until the Civil War began that the pump really begins to turn out lots of guns. Now, at the very beginning, you know, people show up with these sort of rusty old flintlocks from home or whatever, and these people who are going to defend the North or the South in the one battle they think is going to be the Civil War. Very quickly, they realize, oh gosh, this isn't going to work. We're going to really have state-produced, state-subsidized, state-standardized guns if this war is going to continue. So they use this American system, Brian, to really arm the American people with remarkable speed. Now, the Confederacy can't make guns fast enough, so they buy some of theirs from England using the American system. But in the North, they're producing guns in enormous rates, as you can imagine, to allow them to wage war for 4 years against each other.
So, guys, I'm assuming that after the Civil War, those guns are not called back to the armories.
Think of the oil well and the gusher, you know, once you've it's out there. Not only that, Brian, not only are the guns just ubiquitous, they're everywhere across the land, but we have now the capacity to produce, in fact, the need to market the continuing production. This has been a priming the pump of the armaments industry.
Folks, the military-industrial complex.
You get it. It's getting more and more complex.
So, Ed, what's the consequence of the dissemination of all of these guns, and how do we get to gun control?
Well, you have all kinds of consequences, Brian. The post-war Civil War South is drenched in guns and in violence. I mean, this is when the culture of homicide really takes off in the South, and black men are killing each other and white men are killing each other. In the West, the guns are used in the hands of white people who are trying to take land from the American Indians. They're also in the hands of the American Indians who are trying to stop that process. But they are also in the hands of criminals and of young men in the cities of the North who think it would be great to have a gun. So you find it's like a tributary that just floods across the country with lots of different kinds of guns for lots of different kinds of purposes. So in many ways, what we think of as the gun culture of the country really happens after the Civil War.
I want you to take a second now and imagine a gun rights supporter today, all right? I'll bet you're thinking of someone who's conservative, perhaps from a rural part of the country.
And if we asked you to imagine a gun control supporter, you'd probably think of some big city lefty type. But if we could go back to the 1960s and ask a sample of Americans then to do the same thing, we would have found a more complicated picture. We would find gun rights supporters who would have been urban radicals. And we would have found some folks arguing for more restrictions who would have been white conservatives. So let's return to the 60s for a couple minutes, and let's explore why the conversation over gun control sounded so different just 40 years ago.
We're going to start our story in California on May 2nd, 1967. That morning, 30 black men and women walked up the steps of the State House carrying loaded guns. Those men and women were members of the Black Panther Party, and they were protesting a gun control bill under consideration by the state legislature.
and they walked right in the front door. There was no security that they had to pass, and walked right into the legislative chamber while it was in session with their loaded guns.
This is Adam Winkler, the UCLA law professor we heard from at the beginning of today's show.
The Panthers weren't there to commit violence or to take hostages. They were there as part of a political protest, and they wanted to make it clear that they had a Second Amendment right to bear arms and that they needed that right.
After the Panthers were turned away from the assembly chamber where the bill was being debated, they gathered on the lawn outside. One of the group's leaders, Bobby Seale, read a prepared statement warning black people to, quote, arm themselves before it's too late.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed.
For the Panthers, the right to bear arms was a civil right, like the right to vote or to be free from discrimination. And by the mid-1960s, they, along with lots of other activists, were getting frustrated that none of those rights seemed fully protected for black people.
The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act had passed, but they didn't guarantee on the ground equality. And so activists like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who formed the Black Panthers, decided to mimic the motto of Malcolm X, that notion of by any means necessary. And when Malcolm X and the Black Panthers said by any means necessary, there should be no confusion about what they were talking about. They were talking about guns.
There's been a lot of talk said recently because I was supposed to have said something about Negroes should buy rifles.
This is Malcolm X in 1964.
White people have been buying rifles all their lives. No commotion. America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States. You read it for yourself. What is that now? What article is that? The Second Amendment to the Constitution spells out the right of people under this particular governmental system to have arms to defend themselves.
Malcolm X and the Black Panthers were hardly the first to make the connection between guns and civil rights. Immediately after the Civil War, the right to bear arms became a flashpoint in the debate over the 14th Amendment, the amendment that essentially gave black people citizenship rights. In 1866, a Kansas senator named Samuel Pomeroy was among those who argued that protecting freed people's right to bear arms was one of the main reasons to pass the 14th Amendment.
Every man should have the right to bear arms for the defense of himself and family and his homestead. And if the cabin door of the freedman is broken open and the intruder enters for purposes as vile as were known to slavery, then should a well-loaded musket be in the hand of the occupant to send the polluted wretch to another world, where his wretchedness will forever remain complete.
But even as this debate was happening in Washington, D.C., Southern legislatures were passing laws to restrict freed people's rights. Those black codes put strict limits on African-American gun ownership, and they were enforced by paramilitary groups.
Marauding white posses would go out at night in disguise, armed to the teeth, and they would go and invade black homes. And the goal was not just to terrorize blacks, but to take away their guns so that they could not fight back. Those groups took different names depending on where they were in the South. The most famous of these groups was the KKK, begun in Pulaski, Tennessee, right after the Civil War.
The Black Panthers knew this history and were determined never again to be victimized by armed white racists. But this time, from the Panthers' perspective, the immediate enemy was the police.
In Oakland, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton began a practice of policing the police, where they'd send out armed police patrols to follow police cars as they patrolled. And when the police officers would pull over an African American, the Panthers would stand, they'd pull over too, and they'd stand off to the side with their guns pointed straight up in the air or straight down at the ground, which under California law was lawful at the time, considered a non-threatening possession of the firearms. And they would shout out advice to the person being hassled and also just sort of keep a careful eye. A police officer was a lot less likely to beat up an African American when he's surrounded by other African Americans who have loaded guns on them. And this, as you can imagine, the Black Panthers' policy of policing the police didn't make the Oakland police very happy. And so they pushed one of their allies in the California state legislature, a guy named Don Mulford, to push for new gun control laws, laws that would take guns out of the hands of the Black Panthers.
Which brings us back to that 1967 protest at the California State House. It was that gun control bill, Don Mulford's bill, that was under consideration when Bobby Seale and his companions carried their guns into the state capitol. When that bill passed, it banned the public carrying of loaded firearms. The Panthers policing the police was outlawed.
The next year, a major national gun control law passed, fueled by an increase in crime and high-profile gun violence.
Disorder was everywhere in 1967. Newark and Detroit witnessed the worst race riots in American history. When police and National Guardsmen came to restore order, they were shot at by snipers. And then the very next year, 1968, two of America's foremost political leaders, Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, were assassinated. And the riots and the assassinations led Congress to pass the first significant gun control law in over 30 years, the Gun Control Act of 1968.
That law restricted the importation of Saturday night specials, cheap handguns that fueled crime in inner-city neighborhoods. It also banned felons from buying guns and required gun dealers to be licensed. But the law sparked pushback from plenty of Americans. They felt that the legislation prevented law-abiding people from buying guns for self-defense without stopping the crime wave that it was meant to address. Before long, the Black Panthers' claim that gun ownership was their constitutional right began popping up in the mouths of middle-class white Americans. Today, the gun rights movement that invokes the Second Amendment is mostly white, rural, and conservative, a far cry from the Black Panthers.
Helping us tell that story was Adam Winkler, a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America.
We've spent some time looking at gun owners in early America and at the role of guns in the African-American community. We've covered the Wild West. Really, we've covered a lot of ground in this episode.
Except for Sarah Palin. Can we talk a little bit about Sarah Palin?
This is Laura Browder. She's a professor at the University of Richmond, and for her, Sarah Palin is one of the first people to come to mind when thinking about guns in America today. The former governor and vice presidential candidate famously hunted and killed a caribou on television. She was heavily criticized when she put former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords on her target list, a list of lawmakers Palin wanted to see unseated. Giffords, of course, was later shot in an unrelated incident in Arizona. But what interests Laura Browder most about Sarah Palin is that despite her gun-toting persona, she's also seen as the quintessential hockey mom, good with guns and good with kids. Browder wrote about the history of women and guns in her book entitled Her Best Shot. And she says that Sarah Palin fits perfectly into a late 19th century trope of armed mothers, an image Browder calls the Prairie Madonna.
You know, this super tough pioneer mother out there on the frontier with the baby under one arm and the rifle under the other, who was ready for anything.
Right.
There's a very popular book by William Fowler, which was all about, you know, these early American women. And some of the stories he includes are just amazing in all senses of the word. You know, women who will get their hand stuck in a tree in the middle of the winter and use a dull knife to saw it off because they're so tough, or biting a bullet into several pieces with their teeth so they can shoot bears and Indians more effectively. I mean, these are hardcore, tough women. And, you know, the images of these women were supposed to both inspire and maybe intimidate and daunt American women into saying, why can't I be like that? Why can't I be that kind of super mom who can protect my children and my homestead with my gun rather than sitting around in my little city parlor reading novels all day long and wasting away?
Browder says this anxiety about weak women was mainly felt by upper-class whites, a group of people who felt under siege by massive waves of immigration.
We're talking about a period, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when there were many, many prominent people writing eugenics-themed books, you know, The Rising Tide of Color, you know, books like that by Lothrop Stoddard, you know, books that suggested that our very national identity was being threatened by all of this alien blood pouring in and, you know, contaminating mm-hmm. our racial identity. And so white womanhood became very, very important
right.
in this construct. How do we keep white women strong, fertile, popping out the babies as frequently as possible, maintaining their traditional gender roles? And mm-hmm. hunting was an important part of this. You know, shooting was seen as a great activity for women because mm-hmm. it required self-control and discipline, something that women were supposed to be very, very good at. Mm-hmm. And as you move towards the turn of the 20th century, mm-hmm. shooting and hunting seemed like great ways to get women out of the cities, to strengthen them, to get them out into nature and active, you know, because there was a tremendous cultural fear at that time that native-born white women were getting sickly, weak, overeducated,
yeah.
not having enough children, leaving it to the immigrants
right.
to have overly large families that would dilute, you know, pure white Anglo-Saxon Protestant bloodstreams.
Right. So at least in this collective symbolic sense, we're talking about self-defense and being armed to meet the imminent enemy. Does that connect with conceptions of law and order and crime waves? Do we have the beginning of the idea that you need to protect yourself in your home?
Well, that comes just a little bit later, uh-huh. you know, in the early 20th century and on into the 1920s when the law and order element is starting to promote the idea that there's a national crime wave and that many of these criminals, again, are immigrants or people who are not of white Anglo-Saxon mm. Protestant heritage, and that it's necessary for native-born Americans to protect themselves.
Right.
And that's when you begin seeing gun ads that are all about safety in the home. And incidentally, one of my favorite ads featuring a little girl is shown from the early part of the 20th century. It's an ad for a new safety device on a revolver, and the images of a little girl in a frilly nightgown in bed, and she's pointing a .38 caliber gun at her face, and the handwritten slogan says, "Don't worry, Papa, with this new safety device, you can leave your gun lying around loaded."
Great. but what's remarkable is it was acceptable to depict women in these settings with guns.
Absolutely. No one blinked an eye when they saw those advertisements of adorable little girls with big guns. Mm. It was just normal.
Laura Browder teaches at the University of Richmond. She's the author of Her Best Shot, Women and Guns in America.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Backstory goes to the gun show.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Backstory, the show that turns to history to explain the America of today. I'm Ed Ayers.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Peter Onuf.
Today on the show, we're looking at the history of guns in America, who's had access to them and who's wanted access. As we do for each of our shows, for the past couple of weeks, we've been inviting listeners to send us their questions via Facebook or Twitter and on our website, backstoryradio.org.
Hey, guys, gather around. We got a call from Baltimore, Maryland. It's Brian. Brian, welcome to Backstory.
Hello, how are you guys?
We're pretty good.
My question is, in American history, yeah. has a well-armed citizenry actually served as a check on government power?
No, it hasn't. Moving on.
All right, thanks for your time.
Really, really good
Brian,
call.
Brian, I'm going to venture that what a lot of civil rights workers learned in the South as they went into Mississippi in the early 1960s to try to sign up African Americans to vote, which really could cost you your life. What they learned was a lot of those African American families were well armed. And why were they well armed? They were well armed to protect themselves against a well armed citizenry. So mm-hmm. you're looking for examples of protection against the state. I can't really give you one that protected well-armed citizens from the state, but
yeah,
I think
that's a great example.
That this
yeah.
protected well-armed citizens from other well-armed citizens.
Yeah,
I guess really what I'm interested in is, you know, thinking about the kind of standard tropes that you hear in the whole debate. Mm-hmm. And one of them is this whole...
You're thinking about Ruby Ridge. You're thinking about people who ostensibly are going to arm themselves to ward off the big bad government.
Yeah, and just in terms of almost like the argument, almost like a public policy argument. If you want peace, you know, if the citizens want peace and have a government that respects their rights, then they need to keep themselves well armed so the government's afraid of
peace
them.
Peace through strength, as Ronald Reagan would have said about foreign policy.
Yeah.
So you're just applying that to the domestic scene.
Yeah, now it's not. I mean, I find that absurd, but I hear that argument, you know, regularly, and it just seems like. And I was wondering if that really is really part of a strong tradition.
I mean, if there is a tradition of successfully doing that, all three history guys have failed to think of an example of it. Ed, would you agree?
I'd agree. You know, it's such a great question because, as caller Brian says, it's a fundamental sort of premise that we have.
I'd like to explain it if I can. And I think we're deeply schizophrenic about what the state is and who the state is. And a lot of the mythology about mobilizing the people against the state comes out of revolutionary mobilization against the British state. But who enables that mobilization? It's the new Republican states who are desperate to achieve legitimacy, and they need to get arms into the hands of the people in order to meet the threat of the counter-revolution British army. And so at one and the same time, we have state mobilization, state-driven mobilization of militias, largely inadequate, but as part of the larger war effort, against the great fiscal military state of the 18th century, the dominant power on the face of the earth, Britain, with its standing armies. This is the context. It's standing army versus a mobilized and armed populace of citizen soldiers.
And ironically, to cite recent history, some of the modern resurgence of the need to arm ourselves to protect ourselves from the state is not to protect ourselves from the big, bad United States government, which is what it has become with the resurgence of militias in the 90s and the last decade. It's to protect ourselves against the modern version of that British empire, and that would be the Soviet Union. And so as the Cold War revived during the 1980s, you get films like one of my favorite bad films of all time history, Red Dawn. Right? And the Cubans come in as surrogates for the Soviets. They invade the United States. And why can't we fight back? I'll tell you why. It's because liberals and their gun control have identified all the owners of guns in America. So the Cubans go right to the police office. They know everybody who has a gun, and they take those guns away. They defang our defense against that big, bad external state, which goes back to Peter's point about the British Empire.
And it's interesting how often the gun advocacy trope, as you say, coincides with survivalist and sort of post-apocalyptic visions. What we need these guns for is when we don't have the federal state.
That's a great point.
You know that.
No, exactly.
You're right. The jackbooted thugs and the black helicopters and all that are a threat, but we are even more threatened when they go away, when disease or the bomb or something,
and
then we better be
that's
armed.
That's why I said we are schizophrenic, because, hey, the state are us. When we start making war against the state, hey, we're committing suicide. That is a non-political, non-ideological message. Thank you. Okay.
All right, thanks so much.
Hey, Brian, thank you for
great
calling.
Question. Thank you, Brian.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And another call, guys. Herbie from Whitesburg, Kentucky's got a question about guns. Fire away.
Well, I'm in the mountains of eastern Kentucky, and people have a lot of guns here. I mean, the women carry guns in their purses. The men carry guns in their pockets.
Right.
We have 24,000 people in the county, and I might be one of 100 who doesn't own a gun. And I don't know if... there's some history of us being any different from any other parts of the country, but I don't know. From here, it seems that people really like their guns.
Do the other citizens of Whitesburg know that you're unarmed?
I don't announce it very much.
You just did, you realize.
I think I was armed.
Well, you know.
Do you know how many people listen to us in Whitesburg?
We got a fan club in Whitesburg, man. You are in trouble.
Oh, Lord.
Now listen, I'm from Upper East Tennessee, Herbie. This is Ed, so I'm from Kingsport, the greater Tri-Cities metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. So I do understand. I know where Whitesburg is, and I know what you're talking about. And I think you see a couple of things. One, the culture really is very proudly around hunting. Is it not? Is there not lots of camouflage and lots of gun racks? I believe if you ask your neighbors, why do you have guns? Some of them would say, to protect myself, but most of them would say, well, I got it because I'm a hunter.
Yes.
And this is a part of my tradition. It's a part of the culture of the mountains. It's a part of the culture of the South. You know, we've been doing this for, you know, my grandfather taught me this. I know gun safety. And it's just people who don't know guns who are afraid of them.
Yeah, well, my grandfather set me down at the age of 6, and he says, okay, let's go out and learn to shoot. And it was just part of growing up, you know. That was one of the lessons of a young person in the mountains.
Yeah, it's part of the founding mythology of your part of the country, which is also my part of the country. Picture that painting of Daniel Boone walking down the Cumberland Gap, carrying a big rifle, right?
You got it.
Yeah.
And he has to have it to feed himself, to defend against the Indians, and to protect his family. I believe that in an unbroken chain, in a way that no other part of the country can claim, that Southern Appalachia has an unbroken tradition of guns being necessary to sustain the kind of life, which is a fundamentally rural life in connection with the landscape, which involves hunting, that no other part of the country does.
Yeah.
Well, what I believe is that there's more of an obsession with guns now than there was when I was young.
Yeah.
I really think people, for one thing, Walmart carries them.
Yeah.
You know, they're all, I mean, it's easy to get your hands on them.
Yeah.
And people like them. People just like to examine them and, you know, show their guns to other people and talk about them. And it's like a, I don't know, like a collector mentality, partly.
Yeah.
Well,
I think Herbie just made a better point than I did, so I want to build on it if I can. Even though there is a tradition of loving guns, the supply and the nature of those guns have changed continuously over those 200 years, right? So first, there are these relatively rare flintlocks that a family might have had really to have used quite irregularly in the off chance that it actually saw a deer
or something. As a decoration over the fireplace,
Yeah, exactly. And then you would have seen those guns growing old and decrepit up until the time of the Civil War. The Civil War, now suddenly people have modern guns. They have rifles. Then the people start coming back from World War I with new guns, and the guns start being mass-produced. And I think they're one of the first things that people would have invested in that's mass-produced, to get a gun that you can really count on, because you still want to enact this old tradition of hunting for your food. And then, as you say, in the last 30 years, Walmart, Kmart, building on the old tradition of Sears, Roebuck, and mail order, and the result is a profusion of guns. A lot of people who would not have had it before, but who still feel like that they're doing something that's socially sanctioned. You don't have to be embarrassed at church if you have a gun, right? You don't have to feel badly if you have a gun in your car, because it's something that identifies mountain culture.
I remember when I was a child, my dad was taking the gun to work with him every day because the miners' strike was on, and we didn't know what was going to happen. And I remember going in, I was a child, and I was going through the catalog, Sears and Roebuck, and it said, no guns for miners. And I thought it meant that none of the coal miners could get any guns.
That's great. Herbie, this has been a wonderful call. Thanks so much.
Great to talk to you all.
Thank you so much, Herbie.
Bye, Herbie.
Bye.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and we're talking today about the history of gun ownership in the United States.
When it comes to citizens who own guns, the United States is the most well-armed nation on our planet. But over the past 50 years, the percentage of armed households has been steadily going down. Today, the majority of guns are owned by people with more than one of them. meaning that where there's one gun, there's likely to be more.
And as you can imagine, nowhere is that truer than at gun shows. Tables and tables full of all kinds of weapons, from Civil War relics to brand new semi-automatics. In our home state of Virginia, you can find one taking place pretty much every weekend. And so last weekend, we sent our 20th century guy, Brian, here to check out a big show taking place in Richmond. Brian, let's hear your report.
Okay, Ed. When I walked in, I was just overwhelmed by the number of firearms. Basically, every kind of gun that a person could carry. But you know me, no sooner did I start talking to people than I started asking them about the past, and I found a perfect codependent there in my interest in the past. His name was Terry Ellis. He grew up on a farm where he hunted quail, and wouldn't you know it, Ed, he was standing in front of a table loaded, if you will, with firearms from the 19th century.
May I ask you what brought you to the Richmond Gun Show today?
Well, I have an interest in the old double barrels, the craftsmen that were making guns in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And they're hard to find anywhere else in any quantities. You see, this guy's got probably 40.
And how many of these gun shows have you been to over the years?
Hundreds. Hundreds.
When's the first gun show that you went to?
Probably I was 20.
Really?
And I'm in my 60s.
You're in your 60s. You don't look a day over 55. So, how have things changed?
Primarily, there are a lot more military-style weapons, more weapons for home defense, much more so in the last 10 or 15 years. But the increase has also increased the number of people who attend.
Right.
Many more.
So this is more crowded than 20 years ago.
Oh, yes.
And about the kind of people, I mean, some people have said they're more women than they used to be.
More women and more younger people.
More younger people.
And more people really into these military-style assault weapons. It's taken over a large percentage of the tables at a gun show.
Yeah. And does that make you less eager?
I am not into assault weapons or pistols. I own a couple of pistols. And I can understand if there's a market, if the public wants that, that's what they're going to provide them with. Yeah. And that's young people who want those things. The young adults, the 20s and the 20s and teens are into the assault weapons.
That's Terry Ellis from Southampton County, Virginia.
Brian, the first thing you're... interlocutor said, he mentioned home defense, that was the big thing. And it seems to me that word home is crucial here. The word home, of course, is invoked by nationalists all the time to refer to us inclusively. But there's a tension between that home, the national home, homeland security, and the homes that are private homes, our domestic spaces that we need to protect. So it's within the very idea of home itself. And what needs to be defended? What's the ultimate value for us? Is it the nation or is it our little nation in our own home?
Yeah. It's striking this great arming of the household, of the home, is happening against the background of a historic decline in violent crime.
Isn't it interesting? Yeah.
You know, is that if this were a phenomenon of the 1960s and 70s, mm-hmm. when violent crime seemed to be rampant, there would be a more immediate explanation for this. As it is, we may be living through one of the safest periods in American history now.
That's true.
And the other fact is that so many of the deaths in this country that result from firearms are the result of accidental shootings within households. That it's children finding the guns. It's the accidental shooting of someone who's mistaken for an intruder. So it seems to me, Brian, you were at the gun show. Is there not any sense that the very thing they think they're protecting themselves with is the very thing that's endangering themselves and their families?
There is no sense of that. And I think there's several reasons for that. First of all, almost everybody emphasized the training they go through and the care with which they handle these firearms. And on several occasions, I asked people who didn't have guns whether they planned to get one. And they said, no, I don't really feel well enough trained to own a gun yet, and I want to complete this course or that course. But I think on a larger cultural level, Ed, between homeland and home is neighborhood. And what I got at this show was the overwhelming sense of the idealized neighborhood, great homogeneity, great consensus on basic moral, religious, and political values.
Right.
And that sense, perhaps false, of comfort that you get from the neighborhood reassures each of these gun holders that what they're doing is, first of all, safe, and secondly, to make them feel that they are part of the solution, not part of the problem. It's this kind of well-armed neighborhood that is going to save this country.
I love that idea of the neighborhood, Brian, and it suggests the historical appeal of the idea of the Minutemen, the militia, because that's the embodied armed neighborhood.
Right.
You're not then the lone wolf out there facing danger from all sides. It's you and your neighbors united in your commitment to defending your families.
That's where we're going to have to leave things today. But we're eager to hear your thoughts at backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Jess Ingebretson, Eric Mennel, Allison Quantz, and this week for the last time, Nell Beschenstein. Nell is leaving us for a great new gig up in the city of brotherly love. We'll miss her and her laughter a lot.
Jamal Milner is our technical director. Alan Chen is our intern. Our senior producer is Tony Field. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
4, 3, 2, 1. We're not the barrel of a gun. Keep my head weighed down. Stand.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel. History made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
On the next Backstory, when Charles Dickens visited America in the mid-1800s, he was amazed at how sloppy Americans were when it came to using silverware.
Dickens said that he'd never seen such contortions except for a sword swallower in a circus.
It's family dinner season. How are your table manners? The history of mealtime in America on the next Backstory.